Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, on a clear night, you can see countless stars, and if you know what to look for, you might see planets, you might see falling stars, comets, lots of other cosmic events. And today we're talking about space, astronomy, and what the most powerful telescopes are constantly revealing about the universe. And we'll talk with a couple of guests for you today. From the UW Space Place, Director Jim Lattice with us. Jim, good to have you back.
Morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
Also with us today, astronomer, author, and podcaster Dean Regas. His podcast is titled Looking Up with Dean Regas, and it's produces that for Cincinnati Public Radio. Dean, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Well, as we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about maybe planetary alignments or maybe what makes a dim star shine brighter or how solar flares affect the northern lights? We can talk about all that and a whole lot more. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jim, let's start with you. On Tuesday, July 11th.
Ninth.
Ninth, is it? Oh, I had the date wrong. The UW Space Place Outreach Center will be holding an open house.
Well, that's right. We'll have our... have our guest speaker, who will be none other than Dean Regas, on Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on the 9th.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Dean what he's going to talk about. But when people come to an open house, what do they typically see?
Well, this is Space Place is partly a museum and partly an outreach and event center, small events. So we're not Monona Terrace or anything. But we have a large exhibit area with museum quality exhibits from the history of UW astronomy and current science in UW astronomy. And so usually what happens is people have access to the exhibit area for a little while, and then we have our presentation, which on Tuesday night will be Dean. And that's and then of course there's always time for questions and then the exhibit area is open also after the presentation.
Yeah, it's really cool to visit. I've spent some time there with my daughter, and I've always enjoyed it. Dean, what are you planning to talk about at the event?
Well, this will be, I think, my third time coming back there.
That's
right.
And
it's a great place to go. And so my topic is going to be Fly Me to the Moon. And we're going to be talking about the Apollo mission, sending Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and company out there to the moon. And then looking ahead to future missions as well. So since this will be on July 9th, it'll just be about 11 days before that big anniversary when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, July 20th, 1969. So it's still, even, you know, 50 some years later, it is still part of our, I think, our national identity and part of our adventurous spirit. So I always like looking back at those and then looking forward and maybe see who the new astronauts are going to be coming up.
Well, that's the thing to me is that we're thinking about this a whole lot again because the NASA Artemis program is in full swing right now. If the schedule is still a little bit uncertain, but the plan is to send people back to the moon, first time since the Apollo astronauts. So yeah, I'm really excited about this. I think this is a Dean's talk here will be a great way to get us back into the mindset of having people on the moon.
Yeah, that's really great. And I'm old enough to remember watching Walter Cronkite.
Sure. Yeah, I remember that too.
oh my goodness me. Well, you know, Dean, in 2020, you had an expanded edition of your book, 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. I think it was published in 2020. What are you currently observing or looking forward to seeing through your telescopes?
Oh boy, this is summertime is a great time to do stargazing, and I'm the author of 6 books, and that one is called 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. That one tells you how to find things season by season. And for me, how I got started in this business was I didn't know anything. I am not I'm a completely self-taught astronomer. I started working at a planetarium basically because nobody else wanted to, and they said, "Dean, you're in charge." And that's where I had to learn the night sky. And so that's why I wrote that book, was to kind of show how I went from not knowing anything and how I learned to navigate the night sky, because it can be kind of intimidating looking up there and seeing all these dots. So looking for basic, real easy stuff, like things like called the summer triangle. That's the three brightest stars up in the eastern sky all summer long. Really great to look for. And then there's the Scorpius and Sagittarius down the southern sky to look for. And then you can get out a pair of binoculars and start scanning around too. But I think the big thing is to get through that initial intimidation factor of thinking, "There's no way I can identify these things up there." And just getting a few footholds in there with the Big Dipper, with the summer triangle, and then it'll just start opening up for you, and you'll get hooked. That's the only problem, is that you're going to get hooked on astronomy. So just get ready for that. But it's a great season to start doing that.
That'd be a good problem to have.
Yeah,
Okay.
summer is a great time of course, lots of reasons. You have to stay up a little later. It doesn't get dark until a little bit later. And this summer in particular, we actually don't have any bright planets. We do our astronomy department does a Universe in the Park statewide Universe in the Park programs all summer, and those usually the first thing you'll look at is whatever, Jupiter or Saturn, some bright planet. But we don't have those, and so this summer, we will next summer. But we've got to move on a little bit more. I was testing a new telescope in the driveway the other night, and one of the little girl lives next door came over, saw the telescope, and came over. So, well, no planets, sorry, but I can show you some nice double stars, which are easy to pick out in the sky. Like Dean said, you can kind of work your way through constellations to find things that aren't planets, but you can still see from even the middle of the city nice double stars and star clusters and things like that.
In July, there's Joel was telling me there will be an occultation of the star Spica?
An occultation.
Yes, I'm sorry. By Earth's moon. Is that something we see? Occultation?
With that, I don't. Yes, no, normally you can see an occultation if we're on the right side of the Earth at the right time.
What is an
occultation? Oh, sorry. In that case, it almost surely means, chip in on this, Dean, if I'm wrong, but it's an occultation by the moon. The moon moves in front of a bright star. Spica is a bright star in the constellation Virgo, which is low in the western sky in the evenings these days.
Absolutely. This is one I've been kind of had on my radar just recently because, yeah, the moon will slide in front of these stars occasionally, but usually not some of the brighter ones. And Spica is the first magnitude, one of the brightest stars in the nighttime sky. And so on the night of July 13th, the moon will just cover it over. And so one moment you'll see this little star, this bright star next to the moon, and the next moment it's gone, just like that. Be behind the moon for about an hour. So that's on the evening of the 13th, and visible from most of the United States, including up there. So definitely something to put on your calendar, because you can see it with the naked eye, just flicker out, gone, and then come right back out an hour later. And they're very rare. I've hardly seen any of them, of bright stars like this.
That's pretty cool. So that is, what day is it again?
July 13th.
July.
So that night, that evening.
In the evening.
I have the timing down for Cincinnati, but it's a slightly different for you all up there in Wisconsin. But that evening, I can check, but it's in the, I think around the 10 o'clock hour, somewhere in there is when it goes out.
Yeah, Spica goes down reasonably early, so it's going to have to be still in the early evening.
Let's see. I'm just going through some things in my own head. The Perseid meteor showers. It comes up in mid-August.
Yep, mid-August is the peak.
And that could be one of the best shooting star displays this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, typically the Perseids are one of our better ones.
Yeah.
It's always our hope. And so, yeah, meteor showers are always fickle beasts. Like, you never know what's going to show up or how many shooting stars you'll see. I would say most people, I hate to tell people, most people are usually disappointed by meteor showers because they go out and they go out early and they think, oh, I'm going to see like the sky falling and everything. So a typical Perseid shower, I consider it a success if you see about 12 shooting stars an hour or something like that, about once every 5 minutes or somewhere around there. So I always try to get people to lower their expectations, but still get out there to see it, because even if you don't see some shooting stars, you'll still be able to see some nice stars and do some stargazing while you're at it.
It depends a lot on just where you go. You want to find a dark sky location if possible, and you'll see much fewer in the city where there's light pollution, and a lot more if you get out into a dark sky, because most of the meteors are dim.
I can remember a late night in the Shawamigan National Forest in November, and I saw many more than one every 5 minutes. there was no light.
It's probably a cold one too. That's the pluses of the Perseids. You know, August 12th, August 13th, you get a little better weather. But so if you think back to your childhood and time's getting away, you might see some shooting stars. So August 12th, 13th. A good shot for it.
What causes the shower to come by every year?
Yeah, this is from a comet. So a comet passes by and leaves a tail behind. So it leaves particles from this comet. And so that orbit of that comet is pretty steady. So every year the Earth passes into the remnants of this comet. And it's like it slams into this debris, and the debris just falls as shooting stars. And most of these are really small particles, you know, the size of a grain of sand, and they burn up in the atmosphere. Almost none of them would make it all the way to the ground, but you see it for those brief moments streaking across the sky.
It's amazing that the light that can come from something that small.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of energy there. Those things are going at, 50,000 miles an hour or something like that when they cross into the Earth's tens of thousands, we'll say, miles an hour when they cross into the Earth's atmosphere. So they release a lot of energy all at once. And so, yeah, that's where you get that flash in the sky. And it's this point in space where the Earth's orbit more or less intersects with the comet's orbit. It's not... the comet's orbit is kind of extended, or the comet's zone where it's left debris, like Dean was saying. But we encounter that place in our orbit on an annual basis, of course, because that's what it means for the 1 year to pass. So we annually go through these clouds, and if we get through the dense ones, we get a really good meteor shower. It also helps when the moon cooperates. The moon should be pretty good this year. That is pretty good at staying out of the way. It's going to set early in the evening, so we'll have a dark night that night.
Our guests today, Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, Dean Regas, author, YouTuber. His podcast is titled Looking Up with Dean Regas, produces that for Cincinnati Public Radio. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at what you can see in the night sky in the summertime with our guests, Jim Lattice and Dean Regas. Great to have you listening in. Questions for our guests, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Skip and Milton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Skip. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I just got on the show late, but I got on right away, so I'll have convenient. Want to share an experience I had over 50 years ago. It was the Perseids meteor storm, not shower, but storm. That's what Sky and Telescope and Astronomy Magazine described it as, and it really was. We were, it was the new moon, perfect conditions. We were there for the peak of the shower. We didn't even plan it that way, but it turned out that we were there in the right place. In Colorado, Mount Zirkle Wilderness area, and we were at about 11,000 feet, the new moon, so there's no light pollution there. You're miles away from the nearest small town. and it was breathtaking. We'd see sometimes two or three simultaneously at the same time. They were just zing, 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 and it took our breath away. It was a bolide that exploded, and it lit up the mountains for like 15 seconds. It was just broke into thousands of pieces. It was just, it was hard to believe what we were seeing. It was just so incredible.
Oh man, Skip, thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I've seen a Leonid meteor storm a few years ago. Around 2000, we had a couple of years of Leonid storms, but seeing those things are pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully a lot of people got to see the total solar eclipse in April, and then hopefully you guys got to see the Northern Lights in May. I'd say a meteor storm is definitely in the top three of the thing to see in the night sky. They're very rare. I think Jim's right. The last one was the Leonids in 2001, but that's so cool to have that experience. And so, you know, things come in threes, right? So we had solar eclipse, Northern Lights. Then of course, you know, it's natural. We're gonna have a meteor storm, right? Yeah, or nova, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
Oh man. Well, Skip, what Skip described is kind of what I was seeing in the Shawangunk National Forest. There would be two or three at a time that you'd be seeing in the sky. It was.
So that's getting up there where the skies are dark.
Pitch dark. Yeah. There were no lights.
Yeah,
and
that helps a lot.
Oh, it was breathtaking. Skip, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Iron River will give you a chance. Hi, Don.
Hey, Don here. Hey, is there going to be any reports of Northern Lights here in Wisconsin for the next couple months?
You're up in Bayfield County.
Well, it's next couple of months. There's a pretty good chance, but they don't forecast those more than a few days in advance because it depends entirely on what's going on the surface of the sun. But we're still in the middle of the solar max period. We just missed one a couple of days ago, and it was mostly it was daylight over here. They got a really good auroral display in Europe and Asia. So it also depends on us being in the right place at the right time. So the easiest way to keep checking, what I suggest people do is look at a website called spaceweather.com. And I check that every morning to see whether there are any particle clouds on what they call CMEs, coronal mass ejections, on the way that might hit the Earth. And those are the things that bring about the auroral displays.
Spaceweather.com. Is the place
all
to go.
One word, space weather.
Mm-hmm. Don, something to check for sure. Patrick in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Yeah, I'll have to plug spaceweather.com too. It's one of my favorite websites. It's got incredible information on it, including there's a supernova forecasted to happen any day now. Could you explain a little about that, please?
Sure. It's not a supernova, so astronomers use those terms differently. This is called a recurrent nova, the thing that's in the news a lot just lately. And it's important to realize that we've only got accurate 1866 and 1946, we only have those two actual scientific observations, that you might say, of this recurrent nova. Which, though, is showing signs based on the 1946 data, it's showing signs again of being right before an eruption. These are actually fascinating star systems. It's a pair of stars, one of which is a red giant star, and matter is, at least this is the theory about what's going on there, the matter from the red giant star is being sucked over onto the surface of a white dwarf star. And this... basically, it's all hydrogen. This layer of hydrogen builds up on the surface of this white dwarf star, and at a certain temperature and density, it will explode and produce a lot of light. It doesn't destroy the star, either one of them, although that can happen in some situations like that. But in this case, the white dwarf is not destroyed. It just burns off all of a sudden this hydrogen, and we see that flash in the sky. And then after another 80 or so years of siphoning matter over again, that critical mass of hydrogen is accumulated there, and then it explodes again. So that's the recurrent part. And because most of the time the star is pretty dim, when it suddenly appears bright in the sky, they call that historically, people have called those new stars. We didn't see it yesterday, but there it is now. So this one is in the constellation Corona Borealis. And if it happens, now this, again, we're basing this on just a couple of past appearances of it, and maybe we don't have the behavior of it nailed down exactly, but yeah, it could happen sometime between now and the end of the year. We can't really put too small error bars on this. We just have to keep looking up. And Dean's book will tell you how to find Corona Borealis. You look high overhead in the summer sky, and if a star appears there that wasn't there the night before, then we may have seen what they're calling T, the letter T, Coronae Borealis is the name of this the star that I looked last night. I look every night, take a look up there maybe a couple of times just to see whether it's popped up.
And sometimes
things that, you know, we've never seen a nova like this in our lifetime. I mean, this takes a star that you can't see with the naked eye and makes it about as bright as the North Star. So it is pretty dramatic. I'm glad Jim is not so sure of the timing as we think it is. I always see that on the internet, like, oh yeah, it's going to happen anytime between now and September. And I said, well, okay, sure, we've seen it twice, so is two times enough to tell the pattern? We'll find out. So, whatever it is, it's got me looking too.
They're called it's called a blaze star too, isn't it? Another name for it?
That particular one is called the blaze star. Yeah, so you can look for it under that name. I noticed that Stellarium calls it that. So, yeah, that's kind of a colloquial name for it. In the star catalogs, it's the letter T, Coronae Borealis, whatever you like.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed us to say they've read the nova will be so bright it'll be visible during the day.
No.
Yeah, that one's a little too far off. Yeah, so, I mean, if you think of the North Star, which is not the brightest star in the sky, that's on the second tier, second magnitude stars, it's something that, yeah, it was not going to stand out compared to the rest of it. But if you take a look at the constellation Corona Borealis, there's seven stars that are just, six of them are just barely visible to the naked eye. One of them's a little brighter. This new nova will be as bright as, well, possibly as bright as the brightest star in Corona Borealis, which isn't that terribly bright. So only nighttime. Just keep your eyes open and watch social media too. They'll probably be posting when it happens.
Talking with Jim Lattice and Dean Regas about the night sky, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org.
Say, can I just jump in real quick with the times?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I forgot all about that.
So the subject of the occultation of Spica came up.
We were talking earlier.
Yeah, and so I just checked when I had a minute here. The occultation is going to happen about in Madison about 5 minutes after 10 p.m., about 10:05 on the 13th of July. So you want to be out there by around 10. And you'll see, like Dean described, you'll see Spica there just to the east of the moon. And as you watch, the moon will approach and then block out Spica, assuming we're not having a thunderstorm at the night.
Which is always a distinct possibility these days.
These days, yeah.
For sure. Starting yesterday, I think it's a comet that hasn't been visible since 56. You can see through binoculars and telescopes. I think it's, Olbers?
Olbers, 13P Olbers. Yeah, that's right. Right, so these are, you know, comets actually come along more frequently than people realize. There's usually a comet in the sky at one time or another. It's just that most of the time they're way too dim, even to see sometimes with telescopes. but they track them through the solar system. But then when they rise up to just enough brightness to be theoretically visible to the unaided eye, then they start calling them bright comets. And so this is actually kind of misleading, because it does lead people to think I should be able to walk out there and look over in the evening sky. So this one is a bright, quote-unquote, comet, but it's just now reaching really binocular visibility. So it's over in the over in the west, in the vicinity, pretty near the horizon, right after sunset, and it's pretty hard to describe how to look for it. There's no real bright objects real nearby, so probably the best thing to do is to look for a chart on the internet, or use a piece of software like Stellarium, or there's all kinds of them on your phone to guide your binoculars over. You're not going to see it unless you got really good eyes in a really dark sky. It's going to take binoculars to see this comet. But it is one that we've had. We had another one back earlier in the spring that was a nice binocular object and was getting a lot of press because the telescope pictures of it. This was the one that had devil's horns on it. There was a lot of there was a lot of excitement about that. But those are binocular comets. You really need to work to find those. They don't jump right out in the sky. But yep, 13P Olbers is over there.
Bruce in Monona will give you a chance. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. The aurora on May 11th, I was photographing for 3 hours on the shore of Lake Monona with the Madison skyline below. And for the first 2 hours, I was only seeing the pink and green. And then all of a sudden, blue showed up in my camera, and I was flipping out. But then at 3:41... the International Space Station came through it as well, along with the Big Dipper's also in the frame and all the shots. It was just spectacular. And a friend told me that the blue was nitrogen, green was hydrogen, and pink was oxygen, and that the nitrogen, the blue you see rarely because it's in the stratosphere, not the ionosphere or something. But my real question for you is, in terms of converting my raw files, is there an accurate Kelvin degree temperature that I should use so I'm getting accurate color? And apparently, you can't see that. I couldn't see the blue. It was just remarkable.
Mm. Dean, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because when you photograph it, this was my experience. So in Cincinnati, we had, we're farther south, we're at 39 degrees latitude, and we had aurora show for just about a half hour that was visible. And so I got a text from a buddy and said, they're happening right now. And I was like, what, because you get these reports and you think, all right, well, maybe. We haven't had auroras in Cincinnati since 2001. And so I pop outside and I could see it up there as a little pink in the sky. And then I take my phone out and take a picture of it. And then the picture on my phone is like, holy moly, wow, that's way better than the real thing. And so your phone is taking a longer exposure, especially if you have some of the newer phones. And so that's the thing is, so if I was telling people around Cincinnati, is like, it didn't look as good as my picture. So trust me. So what do you do? And I'm glad you said that you didn't really see the blue, but your camera did. And so that's the thing, is you really just have to kind of experiment with it and try different settings. Each one has its own different thing, but it is kind of important to let people know the camera wasn't quite what you saw with the naked eye. It still is one of those most incredible shows, and let's hope for another one this summer too. That would be great to do that. Maybe when I'm up there visiting, that'd be even better for July 9th. So maybe, Jim, we can arrange some Northern Lights up there in Madison.
I'll do all I can.
All right.
So just on the photography question, I don't know whether you can play with the color temperature, but all of that, what that means is that's referring to what you would call a thermal source, a thermal glowing object like a light filament or something along that line. And those spectral, the auroras are spectral lines. It's not a thermal source at all. They're just intense radiation at very specific lines related to, as you said, hydrogen or oxygen or whatever in the Earth's atmosphere. So it's kind of up to you, whatever gives you the best results. And try, if you're trying to approximate what you saw by eye, then you're just going to have to play with it until you get it where you like it.
Yeah. Bruce, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Lyle in the town of Sun Prairie. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to share an experience. A friend of yours, Lil Klesig, and I did wilderness canoe trips for 30 years. And one year we drove to central Ontario, floated down a river for several miles, a portage, and then camped on an island about 2 miles or about a mile out into this lake. And at dusk, to the left, you could look at about a 30-degree arc of the northern lights, but then they're totally reflected in the calm lake.
Nice.
If you look to the right, there's a total eclipse of the moon, also reflected back in the calm lake. And there's no way to share that. You couldn't pass on any video. It was just a total experience for about an hour and a half. And Lowell and I were memorized, and it was a very late night getting in the tent.
Oh, man, that sounds great. I bet Lowell sat there with his mouth open.
those kinds of things, you know, it's you could plan the lunar eclipse, but you can't plan the aurora. And so to luck into a situation like that, but you know, it isn't totally luck either. You have to be a little bit prepared for that. You've got to be aware of what's going on in the sky and be out there looking. And so Dean and I both often sign things, keep looking up. And I'll speak for myself. I mean that literally, you know, that when you're out in the night sky, study what's overhead, you know, study what stars are up there and things. And then you're a little bit prepared when the really amazing stuff comes along.
And I would just, Lyle, I was myself on a fishing trip in the far north and was asleep. I woke up and then I remembered I'd forgotten something in my boat, and I went down to the shore to take care of it and was treated to the aurora. And the reflection on the lake, it was a perfectly calm, you know, late at night, early morning, and just sat there and watched for a long time. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they're fascinating, aren't they? Yeah.
And I didn't have a camera with me.
So I'm sensing a cultural difference from Cincinnati to Madison. So your nighttime stories all involve fishing trips, and the nighttime stories in Cincinnati all involve this saying: I was outside at night in the hot tub when I saw. I kid you not. I've had so many hot tub stories. I saw a shooting star in a hot tub. I saw you. So. I figure you guys have plenty of hot tubs up there, so there might be some hot tub stories too. I don't know.
No doubt.
I did sit in the hot tub in Tucson, Arizona one night with some friends, and it was in a night when there was a meteor shower, and we would every half hour somebody would say, "Oh, I think there was one."
Whatever gets you outside at night, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Lyle, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Love to hear from you. What's your experience or what questions do you have? Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the sky today with our guests, Jim Lattis, director of the UW Space Place, Dean Regas, author, YouTuber, his currently co-host of our hosts, the Looking Up with Dean Regas for Cincinnati Public Radio. So great to have them both with us. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Mary emailed to ask, what size of binoculars and what size manufacturer of telescope that you guys might recommend for getting further into astronomy? So binoculars.
Oh, yeah. For binoculars, so there's the sizes that you see there. There's usually two numbers on the binoculars. The first number is how much it magnifies. So let's say you have a binoculars. It's where I usually like to start with is some that are like about 10 by 50s. So that means they magnify 10 times and the lenses on them are 50 millimeters or about 2 inches across. So the bigger the lenses, the more you could light you can gather, the farther, the more fainter things you can see. So bigger is always better until you can't hold them up with your hands any longer, that they're too heavy. So 10 by 50s, I think, are a good place to start. And then if you think, okay, I can handle a little more weight, then you can go up to ones that are about 15 by 70s. That means the lenses are 70 millimeters. And then there's even bigger ones than that. So I think those are, as far as brands go, there's lots of different good ones. I'd say it's hard to pick one or pick a type of brand, but you can always read reviews. Reviews are really good when it comes to that kind of thing because they're brutally honest about those things. So check those out online. But 10 by 50s, I think, are good ones to start with for binoculars.
Yeah, so that's those are a little bit, I would call those a little bit high power for general purpose binoculars. They're good astronomy binoculars. A lot of people have 7x35s. That's probably the most common configuration.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have to just have a pair of binoculars. It's likely to be 7x35. Use those.
If you got them.
If you got them, yeah, use them. And they're going to be a lot lighter than those 10x50s that Dean likes.
Hey, I always go big. You know, I go on the big side. I want to see everything up there.
So telescopes, of course, are a lot harder. Were you going to comment on telescopes, Dean?
I was going to let you go first.
Yeah,
I'll go second on that one.
That's even binoculars are one thing because they're really adaptable to lots of uses. Telescopes are a whole lot harder question. It depends so much on what you intend to do with them. Do you want something that's portable that you're going to move it around, or do you want something that's just going to stay on the patio all the time, and what level of technology are you looking for? I usually suggest people look for low technology telescopes to start with. There's all kinds of computerized ones that you can buy these days, and they span a great range in serviceability and reliability. And if you really just want to start in astronomy, then a small Dobsonian reflector, small meaning maybe 6 or 8 inches aperture, that's the diameter of the mirror. Those are the things. Those are good starter telescopes. There are a number of good kits out there. They tend to be better equipped than a lot of the refractor, the introductory refractor type telescopes out there. They come with better, more practical eyepieces. And a Dobsonian is a very sturdy, easy to use mount. So that's generally what I would suggest if you shop around. A really good maker, I like to send people to Orion Optics. And so if you just Google for Orion Optics, I don't want to say their website or I'll probably get it wrong because there's a couple of variations on it. But that's where I would send people.
All right.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think Dobsonian's reflectors are a good way to go. And Celestron is another reputable brand. So Orion and Celestron are probably the best ones. Computerized stuff, maybe you want to steer clear of, at least initially. And size is also a thing too, because I have got one that's portable, fits in my car nicely. And then I've got one that weighs 85 pounds that just sits in my living room taking up space because it's I have to really think about if I want to take it out. Definitely lots of options there. But Orion and Celestron are probably the two places you want to go.
Let's go to Russ in Olmsted County, Minnesota. Hi, Russ.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was hearing you wondering about the night sky, and I'm an expert on two groups of constellations, the Big Dipper and the others. I was a park ranger in Utah in Canyonlands, where you can't see a city light anywhere at night. And it's just great for stargazing. And I was talking about the stars for what little I knew. And there was a lady there who held her cell phone up and took a picture. And all of the stars and constellations were named. And I was taken aghast because what a way to find it out. And She said, well, it's probably on your phone, too. It's on most of them that they come that way. So if you find a good place to see the stars and want to know what they are, you can do it with your cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The technology, there's a lot of cool technology out there. Yeah, I see people do that all the time. I've seen more mixed results with that. People hold the phone up and an app lays it out for them on a chart. And at that point, it can get iffy because depending on how much of the sky you've got zoomed in or out on your phone, trying to translate that into what you see in the sky takes a little bit of practice. But yeah, there are a number of really good apps that will do that. They'll lead you around the sky. They're really great.
Yeah. Dean, comment?
Yeah, they are pretty cool. Pretty much any of them. There's some called like Star Walk, Sky Safari, Go Sky Watch. They all pretty much do the same thing. You aim your phone up there and it'll tell you what it is. They're pretty good. They're not quite ready to replace Jim and myself as your guide out there in the sky. But, you know, if I'm not out there with you, a phone's probably your second best thing.
I have a Star Tracker, and it has a song that is associated with it. And butt clicked it once, and it's sort of this heavenly song comes on.
Yes.
And I'm suddenly hearing this song, and I'm wondering, what in the world am I dying now? What's happening?
That's what's the astronomer soundtrack. Whenever Jim and I are walking around in public, that's always playing in our heads.
Oh, boy.
You know, yeah, as astronomers, that's what's always going on.
I turn the audio off as soon as I start that thing up.
Oh, well, it caught me by surprise because I hadn't heard I somehow managed to click the audio on as well as, anyway.
The soundtrack of your life.
Let's go to Frank in Madison. Frank, hi.
Hi, this is Frank. I actually am a member of the Madison Astronomical Society, so I come down to Space Place every month.
Hi, Frank.
For the meetings. Hi, how you doing, Jimmy? So, I've seen the total solar eclipse, and that has to be the most exciting experience I've had. But I had one that actually rivaled that about 25 years ago. I was going to go out to view the Perseid meteor shower, and a friend of mine came by late at night and said, well, no, we can't see it. It looks like it's cloudy outside. And I looked up and I said, oh, wait a second, hold on. I got fooled by this once before. So we went out anyway. We went out to the observatory that's out west that the UW has. Nice place to that we could observe. And as we went out there, I saw, these are not clouds. These are spectacular aurora borealis. They got better as we went out. And so we laid down on the grass all night. And we watched a fantastic Perseid meteor shower and the best aurora borealis I've ever seen. It must have been actually at our location because it covered most of the sky.
Wow. I've never seen anything like it.
Good boy. That's really cool. I'm 25 years ago, I was around here. I don't remember that, but I must have missed that one or something. That sounds wonderful, Frank.
Yeah,
it really is the only thing that can rival total solar eclipse is the auroras. I mean, that's the only thing in the ballpark as far as coolest things to see in astronomy. So so glad you got to see that.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Appreciate it. Well, Michael in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Larry. This is Michael in Madison, and I just want to tell you about an experience I had in Colorado about 20 years ago when I was archery hunting with four or five other guys for elk in the Colorado mountains. And they all took off, and I'm the oldest of all of them. I'm 80 now. And we all agreed to meet back at camp at dark. And I got back earlier. It was a real nice evening, and it was still light in the sky. And I just went out to where I know they were going to come back. And I look up in the sky, beautiful, and a couple of stars I could see. And all of a sudden, to my left is this cloudy thing rolling through the sky. And it had to be like less than a half a mile from me. And it was all cloudy. and it was moving so fast. And I thought, oh my God! And I didn't have my camera with me, and all of a sudden, it went over the mountain range I was standing next to, and it just like two big boulders just crashing into each other. And I heard it boom, and then it was boom, 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 and I couldn't believe it. And it obviously was a rock coming through our atmosphere. And just beautiful to see, and it's a loud, loud boom. I've never seen anything like that or heard anything like that before.
Wow. You must sounds like an audible bolide. There are reports of those, but it's pretty rare to actually hear one. And I don't know. It's hard to tell from your description. You can't really tell by looking at them how close they are to you. But you were pretty lucky to see something at that range.
Yeah, Dean, you're nodding too.
Yeah, you see something like that, a big meteor going across the sky. I know they always look like they're very, very close to you, but when they're lit up, they're about 40 or 50 miles up. That's where the deceleration happens. That's where the big bright flashes happen. And so generally speaking, yeah, you think they're going to come right down next to you, but they're way up there. And then as far as the sound goes, maybe you can confirm this, or usually the sound, there's a big lag. So the big one that happened in Russia about 10 years ago in Chelyabinsk, the flash happened, and then 90 seconds later, then the sonic boom happens. And so it's about a 90 second delay from the brightest flash to when the sonic booms usually happen. That's how long it takes to go those 40, 50 miles. So, but it's still a cool thing to see, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll never forget that, for sure, Michael. Thank you so much for calling. Dean, in addition to your July 9th appearance at UW Space Place, you'll also give a talk on July 11th at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay.
Yeah, not too far away from folks in Madison. If you haven't been to the Yerkes Observatory, this is the place where the largest refracting telescope is in the world, made in the 1890s. This thing is huge, and it's just this really cool building and cool observatory. So I'll be there on July 11th for their open house. So we'd love to have people come out and see that. People who haven't seen the Yerkes Observatory. Mm-hmm. They've done some amazing restoration work and really cool event there. I'll also be there on the 10th doing a talk as well. So you can just go to yerkesobservatory.org and find out some more information about that. That's a great place to go and not too far from you all.
And Jim, back to you for a minute for the July 9th appearance. What time in the UW Space Place in Madison?
Sure, right. That's right, at UW Space Place, which is at 2300 South Park Street in Madison, not on the UW campus, but 2300 South Park Street. It'll be at 7. The talk will be at 7 p.m. So we'll be open, of course, before and after that, say from about 6:30 or so, and then afterwards. So that's free and open to the public. So we invite everybody to come down. And again, I agree with Dean. If you haven't been to Yerkes, it's a lot of people don't realize that the biggest refracting telescope in the world is right here in Wisconsin. It's down the road there in Williams Bay. And so that's a great place to go visit.
And who runs that now?
So it's used to be the University of Chicago, but a few years ago, 2018, I think, or 2019, they turned that over to a local foundation, the Yerkes Future Foundation, which is based right there in Williams Bay. So it's now truly a Wisconsin institution based right here in Wisconsin. And it's an amazing, both historical from the standpoint of astronomical history, but it's also beautiful right there on the shore of Geneva Lake.
Thumbs up to that, and thumbs up to both of you. Thank you so much for being with us today. A lot of fun, as always, and I hope you'll come back and do this again. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Absolutely. Keep looking up, everybody.
Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, also a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Sciences. And Dean Regas, author, YouTuber, former outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, and current host of the podcast Looking Up with Dean Regas for Cincinnati Public Radio. Great to have them with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking with the author of True North. I'm Larry Mealer. Thanks so much for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mealer here, and we have a great summer read to recommend to you today. Author Andrew Graff is back with us, and his new book is called True North. Andrew grew up fishing, hiking, and hunting in Wisconsin's North Woods, and this novel is his second book set in that area. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have for him about the book or about writing? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Andrew Graff, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me back again.
I tell you what, I have to say, just before reading your book, I had picked up a copy of Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt, and I kind of felt the same way after reading your book that I felt after reading her book. The characters, you grow to kind of love like the characters a lot, foibles and all. You do such a nice job of writing, just as Shelby did with her book. And the ending of the book in both cases was a little uplifting. And I thought, well, here's a couple of books I'm going to put on a par. They're both really good. So
that's fantastic. I love Shelby Van Pelt's Remarkably Bright Creatures. I actually teach a course at Wittenberg University called the Feel Good Book Club. Uh-huh. And Shelby's is one of those novels for sure. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it was a nice book, and you have a nice book. And paddling, of course, in the first book, your book that we talked with you about, and by the way, was on Chapter a Day, was read on Chapter a Day. That was about paddling. This one is about rafting, kind of. I mean, that's part of it for sure. Yeah. And you've done a fair amount of rafting, have you? I looked in the acknowledgments, I read those at the end, and you have a fair amount of experience with it.
I do, yeah. I began rafting when I returned home from the Air Force. I was a college student at Lawrence University in Appleton, and I started whitewater rafting on the Piers Gorge section of the Menominee River, just in between Niagara, Wisconsin, and Norway, Michigan. And it's become one of the great loves of my life. You know, it's kind of a silly passion. It's like, what do you love to do? Be in rivers and rubber boats, but yes, and I can't stop. So these days, I live down in Ohio, and I get down to West Virginia on a part-time basis and guide rafts on the New River and on the Gully. So it's something I've done for a long time. It's been a rich part of my life, and I definitely wanted to write about the river and the river guides.
Yeah, the river guides are pretty cool. Well, you still get have time to get back up here, by the way?
I do. I'm here right now, actually. I'm I'm on vacation, so I'm up here for a week for the 4th, visiting my brother and family in the Fox Valley. We're headed up north to Lake Superior to see some more family. We're looking forward to stopping at a fireworks stand on our way this afternoon and getting ready. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
So what draws you to the woods of Wisconsin as the setting for your books?
It's where I grew up. You know, the 1990s North Woods of Wisconsin is home. And you know, I tell my writing students, it takes years to write a novel. So if you're going to close your eyes and visit somewhere and imagine it thoroughly, you may as well close your eyes and visit someplace you enjoy, you know? The very first book that I ever tried to write, which never sold, it's still in a sock drawer. I worked on that for 7 years, and that was based on my time in the Air Force, particularly in Kandahar, Afghanistan. And, you know, like the 1990s Northwoods is just a more pleasant place to go in my imagination. So, yeah, when I finished writing Raft of Stars, which takes place in the fictional county in the Northwoods, I knew I wanted to keep writing about the woods and the rivers and the pines. Yeah, it's home.
You do such a marvelous job about describing the place. I can picture it so well as you write about it. Maybe before we go any further, maybe we should talk a bit about the book itself without giving away the whole book. I mean, tell us what True North is about.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So True North overall is a book about expectations versus reality. And what do you do when expectations and reality bump heads? So the basic plot, a young family, Sam and Swami Brecht and their three kids, pack it all up in a camper van for the summer and head north to the fictional town of Thunderwater, Wisconsin, where they are taking over a sort of defunct whitewater rafting outfit from their eccentric Uncle Chip. Sam is the dreamer. He's putting it all on the line. He hopes it'll turn out well, but reality does not meet his expectations. So they have to pull it all off by the end of summer. This young family who's sort of in financial straits, their relationship is rocky, and the foundations of this business they just purchased are certainly rocky as well.
Yeah. The relationship, how difficult was it to write about the couple's relationship and problems, I guess you could say?
Not very. I mean, so the book has two point of view characters, and it's Sam and Swami. It switches back and forth. I think the most important part to me while I was writing it is I wanted to be even-handed. And it was interesting to throw these problems into their lives, like as in you just put it all on the line for this defunct rafting company and you're living in a camper with your three young children. It was interesting to explore that from both sides. Yeah. Give a chapter or so from Sam's perspective, his hopes and expectations, and then watch how that mirrors or rather does not mirror his wife's reality, you know, and what she's experiencing there. The whole book in general was, so I've like had this long time dream of just cashing in my retirement and buying a whitewater company and living my life, you know, with my family. So this True North is a way for me to do that without actually torpedoing my real life, you know?
Oh, yeah, my goodness me. You've got a pretty good life right now. You've got a nice family. You get to go off, apparently, and raft in the summer sometimes.
I'm very happy and very thankful for every bit of it, yeah.
So yeah. Why do you think Sammy and Sam lost their way? What is it about them?
I think they lost their way in the ways that so many of us do. So, you know, Sam and Swami met when they were college students on their summers off as raft guides down in West Virginia, of all places. And they had dreams, they had visions. And then they got married, they have three kids, and reality starts to creep in, you know? And to be perfectly honest, like the more families that I get to know very closely, when we're not just on an Instagram sort of level, we'll admit that at times marriage, family life, all of this is extraordinarily difficult. So I wanted to I wanted to just sort of honor that and write a book about people, a couple, who is right in the thick of things, in all the difficulties, financially and otherwise. And honestly, like, no spoiler alert, but I wanted to work on a story about a couple that made it. I wanted to hope for them and root for them as I wrote them through that summer.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there, you know, it might not be a bad place for you to read something. Have you got something that you like to read from the book?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy to. I do have one, a shorter selection that I'd like to read today that sure. I think speaks to the idea of expectations versus realities out there on the river. So this has to do with this scene has to do with their with Sam's uncle Chip, the old Salt River guide, and they're taking over the rafting company from him. Sam in this scene is worrying about his uncle's future as he retires. What is Uncle Chip gonna do without the river? So here goes. Life changed. The river rose and fell. It was okay. It's what was. Sam was so tired of fighting against what was. Besides, he assured himself, if anyone could live a hard scrabble life of venison jerky and canned tomatoes and wood heat, it was Uncle Chip. That man could thrive under a tarp. As they drew near to Sand Portage Rapid, Chip did something Sam found beautiful, and it removed all pity Sam had felt for the man. Chip buckled his faded helmet onto his head, wrapped his old life jacket around his body, wedged his foot under the thwart, and then leaned out and patted the river the way a person might pat the arm of an old friend. Framed in by the pines of the island and the shore, with the glassy black horizon of the rapids before him, Chip was a king, bathed in riches. Chip had lived, as others had spent their best years tied to desks and machines in tan-colored rooms. Chip had been out here for decades, breathing in pine, tasting the river on his lips, shaking his beard, warming himself on silt-colored rocks, a raft guide.
That's a beautiful piece from a Chip. Chip is a great character.
I really
like Chip. but he never seems to have really quite grown up in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a river guide. He never got the office job, you know? So it was fun to write about the raft guides. So, I mean, whitewater subculture is sort of like an inland surf culture. And the river guides that you can meet in the novel are the river guides you can meet at pretty much any rafting company throughout the United States. There's Uncle Chip. He's sort of the old salt, the old sage of the river. There's Randy. He's sort of the local good old boy who's, you know, in the flannel shirt, but also a great river guide. And there's Moon. She's definitely the mystical river hippie with the tattoos up her legs, and she smells of patchouli oil. So it was so fun to finally write about the river guides that I love so much.
I met a gal like Moon at a resort in Waskasoo, Saskatchewan. And I thought of her immediately because she was just... That's exactly, Lynn was her name, is exactly the same as yes. Moon.
Yes. Yeah, they are real people, these characters, right? Not based on any one individual, but yeah, we're out there. These river guides are definitely out there.
You know, it's possible, you know, thinking about her, she didn't become one, but she could have become a stereotype sort of in your book. How do you avoid doing that?
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring that up. So I love playing with stereotypes, particularly introducing someone as if they are and then showing the depth beneath them. And I think the way to do that, and I'm taking this from Marilyn Robinson, she was a professor of mine, and she said you just actually have to love your characters, even the villains. And that means so much on so many levels, but one thing it means for sure is to just honor the complexity of that person. So yes, Moon is sort of a stereotypical young hippie river guide, but she's so much more. Yeah. And once I got to know the characters and ask them questions like, well, what are you afraid of? What do you really want? What are you running from? What's in the future for you? Then no one's a stereotype. Then everyone's complex once we get beneath the surface. So yeah, I've always had fun playing with that, with this book and with my last.
Yeah. You seem to genuinely like the characters in your book. And certainly they're very recognizable, I think, to any. I came from a small town. Anybody who lived in a small rural town would kind of recognize them. But some of the people that are sort of lesser people in the book, you certainly don't treat them that way. You genuinely seem to like the hardware store owner.
Yeah, Grandpa Birdie. He was fun.
And the local mechanic.
Yeah, Smitty. Yeah, they're super fun to write. You know, they're characters. So I've lived in small towns just about my entire life, and I still do. So I do love and I do like the people in them. And there are characters, and they're rich, and there's fun. There are funny things that are said in hardware stores. So when I started writing about the hardware store where Swami goes to pick up some paint, and this guy whose name is Birdie is back there, he just sort of raised his hand and said, you know what? I have a story to tell, Andy. I'm like, well, Birdie, tell it, man. So he just goes off in front of the kids about the time he, you know, had a bear break into his trailer house and took care of it with what he calls a pump gun, right? So it was a really fun opportunity to just tell that story. And yeah, Birdie had one. Birdie absolutely had one.
And the local mechanic reminded me a lot of the local mechanic. Roy Scott, rest his soul, was the guy that you would sometimes go down to the garage just to talk to Roy.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so the character Sam sort of has that experience with this mechanic, Smitty. And I grew up in a small town that had an old school mechanic shop. You know, there was one gas pump. Someone would still come out and pump your gas and check your oil. And you could give them a little extra for a Pepsi and a Snickers bar if you wanted. You know, they had one automotive bay. But that's not the kind of place you go for, like, really quick service, right? But there's other value there. So Sam had that experience, too. Like, this is taking far too long, this discussion with this mechanic about parts. And yet, I like it here. I like sitting in this job. Yeah.
Oh. Andrew Graff, our guest today, his latest novel is entitled True North. It's a dandy set in Wisconsin, in northern Wisconsin. It's ostensibly a little bit about getting started in a new business where you're involved with rafting, but it's about relationships, the environment comes into play. There are all kinds of things going on there. And it's great talking with him about it. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Andrew Graff, and his book, is titled True North. You may have heard his book read on The Raft of Stars, which is his first book, another dandy, read on Chapter a Day not that far back. So it's great to have him with us today to talk about True North. Questions or comments, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Got an email asking how much of the book is autobiographical. It sounds like a lot.
Yeah, I think in some ways, you know, every novelist is writing about life, right? It's just sort of the, what else could we write about but our preoccupations, you know? This one, you know, none of the characters are based on real people. Not Sam, not Swami, none of the major or minor characters. But it's definitely about home, and it's definitely about family, and a very common experience that we've all had. You know, the one aspect that I wasn't able to rename was the Piers Gorge section of the river itself. So the whole book takes place in the fictional county of Marigami County. But when it came to naming the river and the rapids that this woodchuck rafting company operates on, it just wouldn't let me give it a different name. You know, it's Piers Gorge, and the rapids have the right names in the right order. So there's a scene in the book where Uncle Chip takes Sam down river and shows him the ropes from Mishicot Falls to Volkswagen Rock to the Twin Sisters. You can go rafting in northern Wisconsin on the Piers Gorge River, or Piers Gorge section of the Menominee, and experience the rapids exactly as they are in True North.
You do such a wonderful job describing that part where Chip is telling Sam about, you know, what to avoid and what not to avoid. And what's the term you use? Is it giving up?
Yeah. Give up, stir up.
Yeah.
Give up and stir up. Yeah. Yeah.
Giving up. And what is the other part of it?
Squaring up.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Give up. So the river has become this great metaphor in my life, you know, and I've rafted since 2004. And I hope to raft for many years to come, but it's not the thrill that brings me back, but it's rather just the art of the river and its lessons. So one of the greatest lessons, from the river that I was able to bring into this book is the term give up and square up. It's a term they taught us in West Virginia and drilled into us in training. Give up, square up, give up, square up. And what it means is if you're running sideways, paddling with all you've got away from some big hazard downstream, some big hole that you do not want to hit, and it becomes apparent that you are going to hit that boulder, then that term, give up, that phrase, give up and square up, comes to mind. What it means is you give up trying to run away, and you square your boat up downriver, pointing at the hazard. And it's this ultimate radical acceptance of reality, that balance of expectations versus reality. I expect not to hit that big rock. I don't want to hit that big rock, but I am. So if I'm going to hit it, I may as well give up and square up to it. So it was really fun to ask, well, what does it mean to give up and square up in other aspects of life? Things like starting a small business. What does it mean to give up and square up in a relationship, right? When those boulders and obstacles come. That was a really fun metaphor to begin to ask of other aspects of Sam's and Swami's lives.
Do you ever have one? Well, you probably had many times where you had to square up.
Absolutely.
On the water.
I had one.
Give me an example.
No, I was just telling my family, I went down for my first rafting run last week on the New River, and I ended up flipping my entire boat in a class 5 rapid called Double Z. And it was my first run of the season. And I was out in the middle of the current, and I got pushed in front of a big boulder. And you know what? I failed to square up. I really did. I hit it sideways, and then I remembered as we were flipping and going over, I just said, "Oh yes, that's right. I forgot my own favorite phrase." Yeah, yeah, yeah. It happens. It's part of it for sure.
Well, the conflicts between Sam and Swami. By the way, how'd you come up with the name Swami?
So Swami's dad is the one who came up with Swami's name. And back in the 60s, Swami's dad wanted to give up the Chicago suburban life, and he wanted to move out to Southern California and become a surfer. He started reading surfing magazines. So when she was born, he named her after one of the famous surf breaks out there. And they went out there, you know, they called it avocado dreaming, and he had these big visions, but it didn't work out. And they all ended up having to get in a station wagon and drive back across the country, broke. So yeah, even Swami's father had that sort of vision versus reality thing come in. It was baked into her name.
That and that, I think that whole business of that part of her life sort of set her along a certain path.
It did. So she has those memories of being on a beach with the sun on her back, bare feet, seagulls in the air, and it was good. However, that vision to go out to California also, like, completely, it made them completely broke.
Yeah,
they failed at it, and they had to move back with not much. And her mom had to rise up and sort of become a breadwinner in that family. So Swami, even though she loved that space, it was good, she was also hit with these really practical repercussions that made her stop dreaming, made her think that wasn't okay. We just need to be practical and get the job done. That personality trait definitely bumps up against her husband's during the course of the novel.
Yeah, communication between the two of them. I thought you did a nice job. I mean, they were both miscommunicating, it seemed like to me.
Yeah, absolutely. They had trouble. And, you know, just the way life showed up. So, you know, Sam is maybe going to lose his teaching position. They don't have much money. They have kids. Their marriage is sort of rocky. And he rubs his hands together and says, "I have a plan," right? Like, let's live in a camper. That will fix everything. He's got this dream. Yeah. But to communicate that dream and then to actually live in a camper and keep communicating that dream became very difficult for Sam and his wife out there. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell you, Swami was difficult for me to like. And I thought, well, maybe it's because I'm a man. I asked Jill, executive producer. She'd read the book and really enjoyed it too. But she said, "I had a hard time with Swami. It made her difficult."
That's definitely fair. That's fair. And I've heard many others share that same experience, you know. Swami has to give up a lot of control if she is to thrive in this new environment. That's sort of her journey. And Sam has to gain control, you know, kind of come down out of the clouds a little bit. To be fair, one reviewer did say of Sam, he said, "Sam is going to remind a lot of women of their first husband." So, you know, they both have their shortcomings, to be sure. Yes.
You know, while she is a strong person in a lot of ways.
She is.
And actually, now that you're talking about, now that I'm thinking about it, there the women in the book, and there's more than one, more than Moon. There's the mother. Whose mother? Randy's mother, was it?
Debbie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strong. I mean, these are strong women.
They are. And I, you know, when I think back to my childhood in the 90s in the Northwoods, with this novel and with Raft of Stars, the women I knew and know were strong and are strong. And you know, I've thought about this too. You know, why are the men sort of bumbling in a lot of my stories and the women are not? Maybe I think that just comes from an impulse that it's easier to pick on my own kind, you know? like I'd rather have a bumbling male character and explore that. But to be frank, yeah, it just comes from a reality that I experienced. You know, Debbie is out there. She's a widow and she's gardening and she's farming and she's hunting and she's providing. She's also a bit of a prepper. That was fun to explore. Well, she's not a bit of a prepper. She's a lot of a prepper. But yeah, I met these women, you know, I've met them.
Yeah, I have too. How much attention do you pay to, you mentioned reviews. Do you pay much attention to reviews?
Well, you know, this is my second book, so I'm kind of new to this whole thing. I'm appreciative of anyone who reads anything I write. Like the whole process has been one I'm grateful for. I think with this one, I definitely paid attention to the reviews until I stopped being scared. It was like my sophomore novel, so I just thought, man, is anyone ever gonna want to read this one the way they wanted to read Raft of Stars? So once it became clear that at least a few people had and they enjoyed it well enough, I was super content.
I haven't read any of the reviews, so I'm glad there's some good ones out there because yeah. I really liked it. That's for sure. And Marilyn did too. We got an email from Marilyn. She just finished reading True North and loved it. Marilyn said she didn't want to take it back to the library. She wanted to hang on to it. And she says that you made the authors, the characters so real that she found herself telling the couple to figure things out.
Oh, that's good, Marilyn. Marilyn, thank you so much. And I was trying to tell the characters that too. Yeah, figure it out, right? So I was rooting for them. I didn't know exactly how their summer would go, but I was definitely rooting for them as they went.
Yeah, she also noted that, you know, just learning things about the river and Piers Gorge, and also says thanks for Raft of Stars and now for True North. Please keep writing, she said.
Thank you for that, Marilyn, so much. I will and I am. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm with her on that. Regret plays a part in the story for a number of characters in the book. Were those themes kind of planned or did they just sort of evolve as you wrote?
Those just sort of came in as I wrote. You know, I was thinking primarily about plot, like what's a big marital problem that can get this family with their young kids in at least through a few chapters. And I knew I wanted to write about the river. But regret did start to come in, particularly through characters like Uncle Chip. You know, he's further along in life. He's definitely suffered his own losses. Yes, he's had a beautiful life in that he got to spend it outdoors on a river with a river as his best friend. But you know, he had a marriage that failed, and he had regrets, and he had questions about whether he could have done things differently. I think it's a story about a family. And I think many of us share this, the idea that if we just pack it all up and move somewhere else, we can start living a different story. I think that's a very a common desire or daydream for many.
Yeah.
However, when we get there, we're still there, you know? So this idea of sort of being middle life and asking, is this the story that we want to be living? And do I have any regrets? Yeah. Are there paths that I should have taken and have not? So those sort of showed up, you know, once I just started asking the characters, who are you? What was your life like? Yeah. Regret just sort of showed up, probably like it does for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Laura in Coleman, Wisconsin, was just south of Krivitz. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
And what's
on? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to say I did read The Raft of Stars, and it was the chapter a day book, and then I went and got the book and read it. Then when the new one came out, I read that one, and we really enjoyed it. I had my husband read the first book. He hasn't read the second one yet, but I am recommending it also to our book club. And I just want to say I really appreciate the fact that he talks about northern Wisconsin. I got all excited when he mentioned Krivitz because we're just south of Krivitz. And then I have a theory I want to throw past him, if I may.
Sure.
The Marigami County. I know that's a fictional county, but did you get that? Did you come up with that by combining Marinette and Outagamie?
Oh,
without a doubt, Laura. Yes. Yeah, so thank you, Laura, so much from Coleman. Yes, that is the origin of the name of this fictional county. You know, my sort of home turf extends from, I would say, Appleton area, Fox Valley. Up through Krivitz into Iron Mountain, Kingsford, Marinette, and then up to like the Porcupine Mountains in the UP. So that was the landscape that I draw from for Marigami County. And yeah, absolutely. Your theory is correct. Laura, I wanted to say too, thanks so much for reading and recommending it to your book club. I'll say to your book club and any others, I'm always so happy to meet, even via Zoom, with book clubs. That's been one of the greatest joys. So if that's of interest to you and your club, I'd be happy to just reach out through my website. It'd be great to meet you guys.
Yeah. Laura, there you go. A great opportunity there. Thank you very much for calling. You can call in too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Having some fun talking with author Andrew Graff about his book. It's titled True North. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. And if you type in Andrew Graff, Raft of Stars, or True North, it's going to pop up, and you're going to, if you did want to contact him, it's pretty easy to get a hold of him. Just type in his name, and it'll probably pop up. It's, I had another question here that it suddenly flew out of my brain, but now I think I've got it back. There are so many other things that are going on in this. All right, so they go to north in this Winnebago, and they get up there and they find the woodchuck rafters are not in great shape. So that's one thing, but there's also sort of there's a mining company involved. There's and I think, you know, there's where community kind of comes in. I mean, and it's something that folks in northern Wisconsin and other places have had to, I don't know if deal with this is the right stage here, but you've got a big company, there's job offers.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Two of the obstacles that came their way, Sam and Swami's way, were the competitors to Woodchuck Rafting Company. So Woodchuck, as you said, is rough around the edges. It's a small, old outfit that never had any competition. But now there is competition in town, right? And they've got a flashy new bus, and it's 1990s, so they're all like, you know, Juicy Fruit Gum, Mountain Dew commercial, and they're with it, you know, this new company. They're a real threat. So there's competition on the river, but then there's also a threat or competition with the river itself. An exploratory mining company is exploring the riverbanks along the Menominee River, and they're buying up land and maybe threatening the future of the river itself. However, in a small town, you know, I grew up in the Northwoods, good paying jobs can be hard to find, right? So a community has to balance. Yeah, there's an economic reality here where we will support our families how we can. And there's also these environmental concerns of is this way of supporting our families going to damage the environment itself and make this place inhospitable? It was fun to go back and look at environmentalism in the early 1990s, you know? So the book takes place in 1993. There was a historic flood in the Midwest. I remember it as a kid. I remember the Menominee River being sandbagged along the banks. And I remember footage of Al Gore riding in a duck boat through Grafton, Illinois. So it was fun to go back and look at, you know, the old Earth Day speeches from the early 90s, and to go watch old C-SPAN footage of Gore and Clinton in their first term. Yeah.
Yeah, and I assume that's why you chose 1993, or did you have that in mind? And
it was sort of a happy mistake, actually. So Raft of Stars takes place in 1994. This one takes place in 1993. I am working on something new that is going to take place in 1995. I'm kind of stuck in the Northwoods still, you know? It hasn't felt stale to me yet, so I don't know if I'm just going to spend the next 20 years writing the entirety of the 1990s in Maragami County, but as long as it feels fresh and fun to me, I'll definitely keep going in that direction. But the year of 1993 made a lot of sense. You know, the landscape itself started lending momentum to the narrative, the landscape and the year. So you've got this family on the rocks, this business with too much competition, this community that doesn't know what they're going to do with this mining company and these jobs. And as the novel goes on and the rainy season comes, the river itself begins to raise and lift and flood.
Yeah, there is a lot going on in the book, and it's plots. I mean, you know, there's something new around every corner or every chapter, kind of, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like loud plots, you know, and I think some of that comes from my early writing experiences. I mentioned that I spent 7 years working on a book about my time in the Air Force. And that one never sold. And the reason why is that the editor said, man, you have written a really long, really boring novel. And I cried in my pickup truck with that news. You know, it was just north of Green Bay, of all places. I just let it rip on the highway and mourned the loss of my project. So when I re-entered writing and wrote Raft of Stars and now Thunderwater, I pay attention to plot. I really do. I don't forget that, oh, wait, what I'm trying to do is tell a story. I'm not trying to write an essay. If, you know, essays have their place and thesis statements are good, but storytelling's not the place for that. So, yes, I absolutely pay attention to plot and try to keep the stories moving.
One of the characters in the novel, and I'm not going to say who, dies.
Yes.
How'd you make that decision?
Yeah, I'm not going to say who either, but it just... Okay, so I mentioned before that characters sort of volunteer themselves for things. You know, once you get to know them, once you get to know their lives and their histories, they volunteer to say things, do things, tell a story about a black bear that broke into their home, whatever. This character's life, it just sort of became apparent that this was going to be the outcome. I didn't know it going in, but about midway through, it's like, yeah, this is going to be a final river season in this sense. Yeah.
It was interesting to me. I was surprised at first when I read it, and then I thought, this is fitting that this person, in a way, passes on. We haven't talked at all about the kids. Mm. In the children in the story who are present kind of almost front and center a lot. Darren is getting to be a little bit, he's growing up a bit, and mm-hmm. he gets this compass. And does that... Well, what does it symbolize in the book and how it relates to the... It has to relate to the title some way.
Yeah, absolutely. So the whole family needs to find, figuratively speaking, their true north. You know, we've already talked about how they come up against it in terms of the business and what's going on in the community and their marriage. So they have to decide what is our true north? Where am I as an individual and I am, as a part of this family, going to point? What's going to matter most? So these kids, these three kids, there's the boy Darren and then his little sisters Del and Deidre. And they, like kids often do, I think, can feel a bit pushed to the periphery from the adult world. When Swami and Sam are so caught up trying to just keep this business and family afloat, it's the kids who kind of get forgotten, right? So Swami and Sam both have moments in this book where they have to question that. They have to question, am I scrambling so hard to keep this thing afloat that I'm the one who's going to overturn the boat and sink it, right? So a turn back to those kids. And you're right, Darren does have a compass on a lanyard that he wears around his neck. And that was fun to just watch a 10-year-old kid use a compass on a road trip, right? Like, hey, mom, we're headed east now, you know, with a map in our lap. But it was also fun to begin to integrate that. Well, what happens when that compass breaks? Do we get a new one? Do we not? Those kids mattered. And I would say those kids in the end mattered most.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, you got a new book. You're working on another book.
I am. It's early stages, but it's coming, and I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll be looking forward to talking with you about it when it comes out. I know it's going to be good. Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm sure we'll be talking about your next novel. This, both your first two published are great books, and it's been a joy and pleasure for me to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough. Thank you.
Andrew Graff is the author of Raft of Stars, first, and this book that we talked about today, True North, a novel, and a really fun novel to read. And I want to thank you for listening, and of course, thank all of our crew, our guests today, and also our production folks. Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn, Joel Patnon, Clara Neipert, and Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.